Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Holocaust survivor Theodore Halperin, formerly with the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, where he served for 33 years. His topic will be Jewish, Disabled, and Trapped in Nazi Europe. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Faith Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 26, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Institute for Holocaust Education, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Liz Feldstern, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education.
Mr. Halperin was born to a Jewish family in Vienna in 1930. And just these few facts could have easily determined the course of his life, and a very short course at that. Nearly two-thirds of Austria's sizable Jewish population fled the country and emigrated elsewhere in 1938 and 39, but that option was not available to Mr. Halperin, and he will share that with you in his testimony this evening. Of the 57,000 Jews who were left in Vienna by December 1939, 88% were deported to concentration camps, and nearly all of those died. Mr. Halperin survived many hardships during the Holocaust, and even after he eventually made his way to the United States in 1947, his battle to live his life to the fullest and attain the opportunities and privileges he deserved, opportunities many of us take for granted, was not over. Teddy, thank you so much for joining us in Omaha all this week, and thank you so much for sharing your story. And the stage is yours.
Good day, and thank you for inviting me to speak to you today. I'm honored to be the keynote speaker with a better keynote speaker, and it is my sincerest hope that from a personal perspective, how hatred and bigotry, understanding lives on many different levels, how hatred and bigotry affects ordinary people's lives on many different levels. Although the Holocaust, or Shoah, the Hebrew word for it, began over 77 years ago with the Night of Kristallnacht, or better known as the Night of Broken Glass, and ended with the defeat of Nazi Germany in 1945, its undertones and hatred is still exist today, as it's evidenced by the events in the Ukraine and with ISIS as a prime example. Although we live today in the age of the internet and social media, hatred and bigotry has used these advantages to promote and expand an agenda of persecution and xenophobia, and the only way to put an end to these abhorrent and behavior is to educate people, especially the youth of the world, on what happens to people because of ignorance. Let me tell you about my story, which will give you a personal view of how bigotry on two continents affected a whole family and shaped three generations of individuals. My story begins in Vienna, Austria, in 1930, where I was born into a family that consisted of my father, Samuel, and mother, Julia, and older sister, Ruth. Ruth is 7 years older than me, and we have never been very close. My first few years were spent in hospitals because I was born with congenital malformation of hands and feet and along with a cleft palate. My parents were middle-class assimilated Jews who earned their living from a grocery store that my father owned along with the building that housed it in an apartment in which we lived. Up until the late 1930s, life was comfortable, but as the Nazi power grew, so did the deprivation of our rights and the quality of our lives. In 1938, the Nazis marched into Austria and began instituting all sorts of anti-Jewish laws that made life unbearable. My father sensed the doom that these laws foreshadowed and began making arrangements for the family to emigrate to the United States, where my mother's brothers lived. Her brothers, my uncle, lived in Brooklyn, New York, and were successful businessmen who were able to provide affidavits certifying that there would be a job for my father and a place for us to live. At the time, in 1938, the United States required that all immigrants have a sponsor that would guarantee the welfare of the people who were requesting the right to immigrate. Things took a terrible turn for the worse for all Jews lived in Nazi-occupied lands in November of 1938, when Kristallnacht occurred. The night of the broken glass is when all Jewish businesses were looted and burned, synagogues were vandalized, Torah scrolls and other religious books were burned. This was only the physical property damage that occurred. In conjunction with this, government-organized vandalism and criminal acts were hundreds of murders of Jews, along with the wrongful imprisonment of thousands of Jews, of which my father was one. For 3 days, my mother went to the local police station where my father was being held to petition for his release. She finally succeeded by leveraging my father's war service record in World War I. After my father returned, he put his entire focus into our immigrating, but there was one hurdle. He could not find a workable solution in, and that was the United States anti-handicap immigration law. During this period of time, the United States was still on shaky grounds economically, and the attitude toward handicapped people in general was that they were inferior human beings that could be a burden on society. Because of this preclusion to allowing me to immigrate with my family, my father and mother had to make the hardest decision of their lives, which to risk the whole family's existence or to try to follow the suggestion of the U.S. consulate, which said that once they were established in New York, they would be allowed to send for me. My parents went ahead with the consulate's suggestion and signed over all their possessions, including the store and the building, to, in quotation, a good Aryan, the grocery clerk that worked in my father's store, and left me in the care of my grandmother. My grandmother and I stayed in Vienna until the spring of 1939, but by the time life under Nazi rule had become totally intolerable, and we left for Antwerp, Belgium, where we stayed until the following spring when the Nazis invaded Belgium. As the Nazis advanced closer to Antwerp, we, along with other Jewish refugees, left Belgium and headed to northwest France. One day, on our journey, walking along a country road, I got scared because German aircraft were dropping bombs ahead of us, and I let go of my grandmother's hand. In the mass confusion that ensued, my grandmother and I were separated and went in opposite direction. But my father had a brother living in Vienna also, and his wife's brother lived near Paris. And I would presume that my grandmother was able to get in touch with them, because in 1941, after going to Morocco, she was able to come to the United States and be with my parents. As I walked down the road, I was stopped by an ambulance attendant, but since I only spoke German, I could not understand what he was saying, and because I must have had a look of total confusion combined with my physical deformities, he thought that I was a mental patient. The ambulance crew put me in an ambulance and brought me to the local insane asylum. Although this may seem like a terrible thing to happen, in reality, this was a life-saving event because it led me down a path to protection from the Nazis. I only spent a short amount of time in the asylum because one of the attendants spoke German and noticed that I kept writing letters to my parents, and after he spoke with me, he discovered that I was a refugee and I was separated from my grandmother and that my parents were in New York. Somehow, arrangements were made to have me sent to a local Catholic orphanage where I stayed for the better part of the next 2 years. Although the nuns knew I was Jewish, they still kept me and treated me well, even though they could have been arrested for doing it. I received a good French Catholic education and never went hungry. And in the olden days, the school desk had a hole where the ink bottle was in there, and you didn't have a ballpoint pen. You had the regular pens, and where you dunked the pen into the ink and then started to write. The nuns taught me how much pressure to put on the pen, so that not all the ink would come down and blot the I have to thank them because I had a very good handwriting from them being able to teach me. Things changed one day after catechism. The nuns told me that they were going to prepare me for my first communion. When I told them that I would not accept communion, things became tense. I knew there was a local call of the French underground operating close by, and myself and another Jewish boy that lived in the orphanage ran away and joined the underground. Initially, the unit did not want to accept me, but when the leader heard my story, he took me in. Part of the reason I was accepted was that I told them I would do anything they wanted, and since my left leg is a little shorter than the right, I have a larger hole on the left shoe. See, like this over here, it's the heel is a little higher than the other one. The leader figured out that he might be able to hollow out the soul and hide messages in there. I was sent to a local cobbler who fabricated a secret compartment in my shoe where I kept notes that shuttled between locations. All the messages were coded and I did not know the code. So even if I was caught, it would be of no value to the Nazis. I stayed with the underground until the summer of 1944, when the American army liberated the part of France where I was. Once we were liberated, I was sent to a displaced person camp in Taverny, France, a suburb of Paris, where I stayed until January of 1947. While at the camp, the Jewish organization was able to get in touch with my parents, and passage was arranged for me to sail to New York. To my surprise, when I landed in New York, I was reunited with my parents, grandmother, and sister. And while I was in the displaced camp, I also went to school and finished, almost finished high school in France. In March of 1947, I again went into the hospital to have major surgery to correct my left foot. The doctor performed a radical new procedure at the time that involved bone grafting. I stayed in the hospital until August. Although I spoke French and had the equivalent of a high school education, I spoke no English, so I had a lot of learning to do. And one of the ways that I learned English, I listened to the radio and listened to the Brooklyn Dodgers baseball game. Even though I didn't know anything about baseball, the language, I was able to at least learn how to speak a language. But afterwards, I became an avid Brooklyn Dodger fan. That September, I entered high school and graduated in June of 1950. In September, I enrolled at CCNY, which is equivalent to City College of New York. But I never earned my degree because I could not afford to continue my education. One of the other reasons I discontinued with my college education was I wanted to be an accountant, and when I registered for the accounting class, the professor that taught the class said he would not allow me to come to his class because he did not think that I would be able to write the numbers on each little column. Even when I showed him that I could do it, he and the guidance counselor said, no, we don't want you here. And so for 2 years, I struggled with it, and then finally I said, the hell with it. By this time, my sister had already gotten married and immigrated to Israel, and my parents had followed so that I was on my own again. I took a job working for a manufacturing company as a bookkeeper and stayed there until the end of 1955. I left to join New York City Civil Service as a clerk for the chief medical examiner's office, where I remained until 1986 when I retired. But it took in 1955 when I took the test and passed, I was interviewed by the finance department, and I asked him what kind of a job I had to do, and he said I would have to climb a ladder to get down the finance books and all that for the accountants. I said, no, I'm not going to do it, because I figured I would be able to get up, but holding the book and coming down at the same time, that wasn't for me. So after another 2 or 3 weeks later, the sanitation department called me, and the same thing. I was carrying boxes from offices and bringing to the garbage, and I said, no, that's not for me. I'm not going to do that. When the chief medical examiner's office called me, the commissioner did not want to take me, but I knew I had a friend. His father was a CPA, and he knew a lawyer. So the father got in touch with the lawyer and told him what the circumstances were, and the lawyer was ready to sue the city of New York for it. And when it almost got to court, the chief medical examiner said, okay, we'll take him. Let's not go to court. And so that's how I got my job. In 1959, I got married, and in 1963, my son was born. In 1985, the proudest moment for us occurred when the commissioning ceremony, when we attended the commissioning ceremony on top of the World Trade Center for my son that was commissioned as second lieutenant to the United States Marine Corps. In 1990, my wife and I retired to Boca Raton, Florida, where I stayed until my wife passed away from leukemia in 2007. My son said that it was time for me to move to New Jersey so that I could be part of my grandchildren's lives, and that is where I've been ever since. I would like to ask you to think about my story and know that you have heard a part of history on a personal level from a regular person who had a unique journey to freedom. Whenever you see or hear of hatred and bigotry, know that it's affecting real people who just happen to be in the path of small-minded people bent on perverting society's good nature. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
At this point, I think Teddy would be happy to answer questions from the audience. So if anyone has a question, we have a microphone over here. You can raise your hand and the microphone will come to you. And you can ask your question.
When you were in France and you were, and they took you, did you come by plane or boat to the United States?
When you came to the United States, were you coming from France? Where was the displaced persons camp?
Yes, I came from France.
Mm-hmm. What, you mentioned an organization. Which?
HIAS, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society.
Oh, okay. I was wondering because I was in France, too, and they helped me also. But it was the OSE.
OSE. We have OSE. That's the French equivalent of HIAS in English.
I see.
Okay. It's the same thing.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
No, it's the same thing.
Well, thank you for teaching.
You're welcome.
Me.
First of all, thank you very much, sir, for
You're
sharing.
Welcome.
And I'm wondering, what helped you from caving into the bitterness that surrounded you?
I didn't think about the bitterness. I knew I wanted to live and I wanted to see my family, and that's all I cared about. I didn't think about bitterness. I didn't even know what was even going on, because we'd never heard anything what went on during the war.
Hi. How were you able to communicate with your family when you were when you lost your grandmother and you were not?
When I came here, when I came to in 1947, my mother only spoke German, English, and Yiddish. My only language was French. German, I obliterated completely. I didn't want to have anything to do anymore with it. I didn't know any Yiddish, but luckily my mother had a distant cousin that knew how to speak French. So until I was able to learn English, he was the interpreter between myself and the family.
And were you able to communicate with your parents when you were still in France from the displaced persons camp by writing?
No, there was no way of communicating. Excuse me.
Yeah. I just wanted to add to that. When you were in France, when you lost your grandmother, and there you were alone, and you wound up in the hospital and this institution, how were you able to communicate then with your family? How did they
did
know that
communicate.
You were alive or where they were?
I'm sorry. Once I lost my grandmother, there was no communication between my parents and I until I got to the displaced camp where Hayes was able to get in touch with my parents.
I know you were young, but the night of the broken glass, could you elaborate? I'm a history buff. If you could just elaborate on that a little bit, if you remember much of it.
I was only 8 years old, and I don't remember anything about it. So I'm sorry, I cannot give you any information.
You were at a Catholic monastery in...
What?
Convent?
Catholic.
A Catholic orphanage. It was not a convent.
Were other Jewish children there at the time?
There were one or two other ones.
Do you know what happened to them? Because you didn't take communion, and I take it you had to go somewhere else. So I just wonder what happened to the other children.
I think they... if they might have converted.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Because there were a lot of forced conversions.
So I don't know if you know this or anybody else does, but if you didn't convert, what happened to those Jewish children? Were they?
I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Teddy, can you tell us a little bit more about the time that you spent working for the French underground? Some of the things that you were doing or what life was like?
But besides, besides doing being a courier, we would, it was a farm, so we would go to the farm and pick whatever, like potatoes and carrots and all this, pick that, so we have our meals from that, because meat, we could not get any, and there was very bad rationing. We would even pick herbs from the ground, and that's what we would eat. All the underground was concentrating about was doing sabotage work against the Germans, like putting bombs underneath the bridges or by railroad tracks. But one thing I do remember, that when a German soldier got killed by one of our men, they would round up 20 of the French people and would kill them because of the killing of one of the soldiers. Yes, dear.
Thank you for coming. We
You're
appreciate
welcome.
Your time. What will you tell us what daily life was like in the DP, displaced person camp, and did you make any good friends there that you still contact in America when you came? And what was, you were there for 3 years. What, did you create your own little family?
In the DP camps, people that did not have any relatives in France, I mean in the United States or in other free countries, the majority wanted to go to Israel, which was then Palestine. And that was their hope to do. So they were ready to, and the Jewish agency would come and get the papers ready for them to go, take them, bring them to Marseille, and from there go to Palestine. But a lot of them never wound up in Palestine. They wound up in Cyprus until Israel became a state, and then they were able to go. But there were not that many people that that came to the United States from a displaced camp. Not from where I was.
Were you at? Did you have school in the displaced persons camp?
Not in the camp, but went to school to the public school in the town that we were in, and that's where I got my education, and I was ready to graduate. Mm-hmm. In June of 1947, I would have graduated.
So it was a regular public school, and the teachers presumably were not Jewish, and your fellow students?
No, they were not Jewish. School days were Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday was a day off. Then was Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and Sunday was a day off. Now, the camp that I was in was a religious camp, so we couldn't go to school on Saturday. So on Friday, they would give us the homework for us to do for the Saturday work. So we had the homework for Friday and Saturday to do on Sunday. Mm-hmm. But I didn't mind it. And I had the director of the camp was very nice. He taught me how to... He taught me how to use a hammer, and I was learning how to be a bookbinder, the old-fashioned way with the wood, and how you tighten the paper all together and glue it.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
My question was, after coming to America, how long did it take you to open up about your experience during the Holocaust?
It didn't take that long. Within 2 months, I was able to not do a perfect conversation, but enough to be able to talk back and forth with them.
But in terms of talking about your experiences?
I never talked to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it started was... I was by Harold, and he asked me, "Were you ever bar mitzvahed?" And I said, "No." And I told him, "I'll wait till I'm 83 years of age, and then I'll get bar mitzvahed." And he said, "Why do you have to wait till now? You can do it this year." And also, the grandchildren want to know what you went through, and if you don't tell them while you are alive, they are not going to know it. So he kept on persisting and persisting until with his help, I was able to write an autobiography. Okay,
Mr. Halpern,
thank you.
Thank you for coming. I'm over here.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
I have related to. You have a wise son. I think you raised a wise son. I'm glad that he made you talk. I'd like to ask how your faith played a part in all of your life, if you could summarize that.
When I was able to figure out what was happening to me, I blamed it on God. And I gave up completely on the religion. I said, it was your fault that everything happened to me. When I came to New Jersey and Harold found a place for me to live, there was a rabbi there for the Sabbath services. And I went to the synagogue. I went there because there was nothing else to do, so I went there to the synagogue. And one day, he knew a little of my history, so he said, "Come, I want to talk to you after the Bible study." So we kept on talking for maybe 5 or 6 weeks, and I told him that I don't believe in what happened, that it was God's fault, and he slowly but surely he changed my mind and said, it's not God's fault, it's man doing evil to other men. When God had nothing to do, and so now I am back to believing that way. Is that a good explanation for you? Okay, thank you.
Yes? How hard was it for you to learn all the different languages throughout the year or the years?
Well, French was not hard. I learned to learn. The younger you are, the easier it is to learn a language. Okay? When I came here, I didn't have much. It wasn't that hard for me to learn. But what my mother did is when I started high school, she got me a private tutor, a teenager like you who was also in high school. And he came over 3 times a week, and he would teach me the not so much the English language, but the grammar, because the English grammar and the French grammar is completely different. But that's how I did it. Thank you.
Hello. Can you share what it was like to see your parents or be reunited back with your family after so many years?
It was very hard. The feeling that there was not any feeling that a child has for parents, because the main part of my, for eight years, I did not see them. And those were formative years. I lost the whole childhood because of the war. And it took a very long time to get very close to them. But eventually we did get close.
And your grandmother, you were very close with,
yes,
right?
Yeah, and it was a pleasure to see her. And that's all. It was more about a love feeling between my grandmother and I than between my parents and I.
Oh, yes, I have a question. What were you doing in the underground?
I was a courier. That's going back and forth, the way they did it is they knew when the buses were running, so because I couldn't walk that far, so when they knew buses were running, that's when they would put the codes in the shoe, and that's when I would go back and forth. I would stay maybe in one place and the next day go back. I would not go back and forth the same day.
You were very useful.
Huh?
I said you were very useful.
Thank you. Yes, dear.
How did you meet your wife?
How did I meet my wife? Okay. In New York, there was a Federation of the Handicap place, and we had a group there called Club Laborik, which was people that had cerebral palsy. So one Friday evening, we used to meet on Friday afternoon and either go out to dinner or either have a movie, go to the movie. We did other things. One day, the group leader asked my wife, I had an eye on her anyway, but asked my wife if she would like to go to the Bronx School of Science High School to see a play. And so she said to her, I don't know how to get there. And I heard it. I said, that's all right. I know how to get there. I live near her, so I'll be able to pick her up and take her over. She was hesitant, but she agreed to it. So we went there next Friday, and I made a date for the following Friday and for the following Saturday, and I went to see Carol Burnett once upon a mattress on Broadway. So I picked her up in the afternoon, took her out to dinner at Howard Johnson, and went to see the play, and I took her back home. And then I said, okay, I'll see you next week. She said, sure. So, but what happened is that next week, when I got to the house and her father saw me, he said, no, you're not going out with him. He's too disabled for you. So for about three years, my wife had to have some friends and I had friends, and they made arrangements for us to see each other. So we kept on doing this all the whole time. And finally, her sister said to her father, forget about it. You're having a losing battle. They want to be together. They're going to be together. And he said, okay, if that's the case, we'll accept him. And that's how it was.
When you were able to get to the United States, you said it took a bit of time for you to get closer to your parents.
Yes.
Did you ever feel abandoned? Did you ever feel that they had abandoned you for their own freedom?
At that time, no. But when I came to the States and matured, I did feel for a long time that there was an abandonment. But I recovered that too.
So this question is not really related to your experiences during the Holocaust, but you've seen a lot of change in your lifetime in terms of how the handicapped are treated in this country. Are there changes that you would still like to see?
Oh, there are some more changes, yeah.
What do you think we should be working on?
Well, there are certain changes that I'd like to see but cannot be made. Like in New York City, I like to see changes as far as subway system is for the handicapped to be able to use, but it would cost too much money, and there's no possibility for them to do that. Mm-hmm. But in New York City, it's not that bad because all the buses are all accessible for a wheelchair. I mean, President Bush did a good job when he passed the ADA law, Advancement for Disabled Act, the American Disability Act. So from there on, I mean, we can see children can go to public school today here, and they're being bused, and there's a lot of advancement that were not there when I went to school. So, and little by little, it's going to get better and better. But in all, the United States is still the best country in the whole world.
Thank you for sharing your story. When you were in the displacement camp and you went to public school, did you feel like you were prejudiced against, or did you feel welcomed just like any of the other kids?
Well, prejudiced against, but we had to go to school. And France and Jews do not go together. They are very anti-Semitic, much more than Poland and other countries are.
My son's too shy to ask his question. He wants to know if you still speak other languages like French and German.
I'm able to read, and I would be able to speak French, but I don't have much ability to speak to. But when I start talking French with somebody, after a little while, I'm right in there and be able to converse. But I do read French very well, though.
What are your thoughts of the current administration and here?
Please. You mean with President Obama? I hope that maybe in 2 years he goes away and forget about it. I voted for him, but I thought that he would be better than other ones, but I see he's worse than some of the other ones are. And he's too easy on the Arab situation. I think he's afraid to do anything, to start anything, to help out the United States. And because he's afraid, the countries are not looking favorably toward us.
Teddy, what are some things you like to do with your grandchildren?
Oh, I like to play Scrabble with them, even though they don't like to play that. I play cards with them. I talk with them. Anything they want to do, I'm there to help. If I try to help them out, but they're too advanced in their courses. I am not able to compete with them. They're too smart for me. I have one is going to be 22 years of age, and she's graduating from Rutgers University in May, and I have twin grandchildren, one boy and girl. They're going to be 16 in June. They're sophomores in high school. And they're all three of them are very good kids.
My question is, how often do you see other Holocaust survivors, or how often do you meet other Holocaust survivors?
In New Jersey, there's a Jewish the Jewish Family Service is able to make arrangements every other Tuesday, because of a grant that was given to the Jewish agency. There was a grant, a donation given of $7 million for us to get united. And we every other Tuesday we meet at 10:30 in the morning till about 1:30 in the afternoon. We have a lunch with everybody. But we don't talk about the Holocaust. We talk about the grandchildren. We talk about the news that goes on today. We have certain programs that are being sponsored for us. But as far as what went on 80 years ago, we put that aside. We know we have it, but we don't want to talk about it.
Have you ever visited Israel?
Yes, I visited 4 times Israel because I have a family over there. My sister lived there. She had three children. Two of them live in Israel. They are two nieces. Each one has two children, and the other one has three. So one is still in Israel for one of the nieces, and two live in the United States. They have their own families. And I have a nephew that lives in California, and he has a family. He was in a captain of the Israeli Air Force, and he fought in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Yes, dear.
I was just wondering, when did you know, you said you were very young when you were during the Holocaust, yes. When did you know that you were being persecuted because you were Jewish?
Well, I think the time that I knew is when I was in the orphanage and the orphanage wanted to convert me to their a religion. That's when, until then, I didn't consider myself persecuted. I didn't know what was going on, okay? But once the nuns wanted to convert me, that's when I saw that something was not the same as the other children were.
Did the underground that you were helping in France, I mean, were they not aware of the concentration camps and Auschwitz and so forth? I mean,
if they were aware, I did not hear of them, okay? I would be inclined to think, like you do, that they were aware of what was going on, okay? But I was only from 12 to 14 years of age, okay? So it's completely different.
Why do the Jews in America, why don't I see outrage from them of what is happening?
In Israel?
In Israel. And also... have you forgiven the Germans?
I'll answer the second question, okay? The second question I'll answer you this way. On the Day of Atonement, we say a prayer to God, please forgive us for this and this and this. And also, in the Jewish religion, besides asking for forgiveness, to God for what you did, you ask people that did that hurt you if they will forgive you, me for hurting you. And I will not forget what the Germans did, but I'll forgive them because it's now three generations. You cannot blame this younger generation for what happened 80 years ago. That's the way I look at it. Okay? Now, the first part, that's a good question. Why, I would be like the example of before the Holocaust. People knew what was going on. I mean, don't tell me that the Jews in Europe did not know what was going on with Hitler and in Germany or in Austria. But they thought, oh, I'm a German, I'm an Austrian, they're not going to do anything for me. Germany is my country, and they'll do to somebody else, but not to me. And that's the attitude. And what did it get them? It got them into the concentration camp. That's the way I see it.
Teddy, you have been so generous with your time and coming to Omaha and spending the week with us. Yeah. Any last thoughts for Omaha?
My last thought is I thank you from the bottom of my heart for asking me to come and participate and be a little bit to let you to teach the children or to teach, young people and even adults, but primarily the young people, because if we don't tell them what went on, they will not be able to let other generations say, at least if something does happen, be able to prepare themselves for not to occur again, the same thing.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Holocaust survivor Theodore Halperin, formerly with the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, where he served for 33 years. His topic was Jewish, disabled, and trapped in Nazi Europe. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Faith Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 26, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Liz Feldstern, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education, and Kelly Keller, Director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.